This podcast is brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short. You can find more podcasts and other resources on our website, www.acamh.org, and follow us on social media by searching ACAMH.
Hi, my name's Tim Colebrook and I'm an editorial assistant for the Association of Child and Adolescent Mental Health. I'm here with the CAM Editor-in-Chief, Dennis Ugrin, who's Clinical Senior Lecturer in Child and Adolescent Psychiatry in the Department of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, King's College London, and a Consultant Child and Adolescent Psychiatrist for the South London and Maudsley NHS Foundation Trust. I'm also here with the Deputy Editor-in-Chief for CAM, Bernadka Dubiska, who is a Consultant Child and Adolescent Psychiatrist for the Pennine Care Foundation Trust, and an honorary reader of the University of Manchester. We're here today at the start of a new year to talk about the journal Child and Adolescent Mental Health, better known as CAM. We're going to be talking about the significance of CAM and the upcoming features we'll be including in the new year, and how you can get involved.
Could you tell us a little bit about your research interests and your background? Start with Dennis.
As you rightly said, it was a bit of a mouthful in terms of all of my clinical and academic roles. But what it actually reflects is my interest in a particular field of child mental health, which is self-harm. And my research work essentially is looking at self-harm from different perspectives. Right from the start, from the high-risk young people, children, who are particularly risky in terms of self-harm and suicide and self-harm-related thinking in future life, right all the way to the older adolescents. And part of my research is looking at the optimal treatment setting for these young people, as well as some biological research looking at pain perception, sensitivity in young people with self-harm. So actually self-harm from a variety of perspectives. And the reason why I'm so interested in this is because self-harm, as far as we know, is really the strongest predictor of death by suicide in young people. It increases the risk by about 10 times. And suicide, of course, is the second leading cause of death in young people in all Western countries. And so it's something that really provides an opportunity for us as doctors, psychologists, nurses, and other mental health professionals to make a real difference in young people's lives. I always joke with my medical students that, you know, if you really want to make a difference to young people's lives, you don't have to necessarily dream of becoming a neurosurgeon, because that's not what young people die of. Young people die of suicide. That's really the most promising and the most exciting part of what I do, is thinking about how to prevent this tragic event.
Fantastic. And to you, Bernadka.
Well, I've got many years of clinical experience working in an inpatient adolescent unit, and so like Dennis, I'm really interested in young people with severe mental illness and those who are at high risk as well. I mean, in terms of my research interests, I've been involved in a few depression trials over the years, and I'm particularly interested in how best to maximise the evidence-based interventions we have. So we know that throughout the world, we've got lots of children and people who are really suffering with mental disorders and mental illness, but we don't have enough services and resources to help try and manage that. So I'm particularly interested in how we translate research findings and how we can train up as many people as possible to try and help children and young people with their problems. So with that in mind, I'm particularly interested in brief interventions for depression. I'm also very interested in making sure that we get things right for children and people, so we get the diagnosis right for those young people who have the severe problems. My other area of interest has been bipolar disorder and how you go about diagnosing that and making sure that we don't miss that particular disorder, because the implications of missing problems in children and young people are absolutely phenomenal, and it can lead to years of impairment and distress.
Okay. My first question is going to be for you, Bernadka, because you've been here a bit longer than Dennis, as because Dennis has just joined us in November. Could you tell for those of who are listening who don't really know the journal Child and Adolescent Mental Health, what's it really about? What's it sort of focused on? And from your time here, what have you sort of like gained from it? How has it developed? And how have your own experiences and interests, how have you influenced the journal with that?
I think it's a really exciting time for the journal at the moment, and we're hoping to bring in lots of new innovations, and I'll mention some of those in a minute. Who the journal's for? It's for anyone who's interested in working with children, young people. So from any country, any profession, we've got lots of interesting new innovations for clinicians to look at and read about. And it's a really good journal for thinking about what new practice people are developing throughout the world. So for example, at the moment, we know new technology is playing a really big part in developing treatments for young people. And that's an area that we hope to develop in the future and try and inform our clinicians about the sorts of innovations that are happening in practice. And as well as that, we appreciate that not everybody agrees about particular issues in child and adolescent mental health. And we recently introduced a debate section, which I think should prove to be very interesting, and cover some really important topical areas. So I mentioned bipolar disorder recently, and there's a lot of interest and discussion about what that really means in children and young people. Does it exist? If it does, how should we diagnose it? Are we over-diagnosing, making things worse for young people, or are we missing it? And people have very strong views about that, and so those articles will be coming out quite soon in our next issue. And so I think there's lots of really interesting developments that hopefully people will be reading about, and more people will be turning to our journal. And I'd say if you're a young researcher and you want to get your work out there, this is a really good journal to submit to. But we're looking at really high quality articles. We have a lot of submissions and we're really pleased about the interest, but it's important that we publish the ones that are evidence-based and are scientific and they're rigorous from their thinking.
And is there anything in particular you would say sets or gives CAM its distinctive tone that you'd say, if so, you're meeting somebody for the first time, you're going to say, why you should read CAM? Why should you read CAM?
It's for the clinician's voice. So, you know, clinicians don't have time to read big heavyweight journals with lots of statistics in them. Yes, methodology is important, but this is much more readable. It's readable for clinicians. We're also introducing new interesting areas where clinicians can think about different topical issues like the debate section I've mentioned. We're introducing another section, for example, looking at highlights in research. I'm going to be summarising them very quick, easy-to-read formats. So clinicians who don't have much time but are interested in what's happening out there need to update themselves. This is the journal for you.
Fantastic. And Dennis, as somebody from the outside who recently joined us, so what's your impression of... Oh, but obviously you've published with CAM, you've been involved with it over the years. How is it, what's your opinion of CAM and sort of impression of it? And also, what are you excited to bring to CAM?
I'm very excited about coming to CAM because, as Benathka said, it is really the journal for clinicians. It's a wonderful resource. And I want to just, first of all, thank all of the previous editors, of which very many of them have been quite eminent researchers in their own right. I have to also say that Benathka has been very modest about her research. She said, oh, I was involved in a few depression studies. No, she was involved in some of the key studies that actually determine what it is that we say to families when we meet them in terms of chances of success of different interventions. So it's the British thing, right? It's what people are. They're modest about their contributions. In some ways, it's something that people, and I think in some ways, CAM is this vehicle that is designed to publicize the amazing things that clinicians do. Because as Danke mentioned, many other journals focus on researchers, and researchers that do complex, sometimes exciting, sometimes less exciting, interventions that are pretty hard to understand and digest for most clinicians. But these types of articles, you know, the heavy research articles, they often do not have immediate impact on clinical practice. Whereas CAM is not like that. CAM is supposed to be the journal where we should have the best articles that will say, look, so what it is that clinicians should do differently. What it is that has been discovered or has been researched that actually should change clinical because I don't just mean necessarily simply only just clinicians. I also mean people who, for example, educate, so people who teach others. What are the new and exciting developments in education? How best to educate people? How best to supervise people? How to train people? But also policymakers. You know, what is his, and again, we are very lucky to have Benatka here, who is really the top child psychiatrist in the UK, because she knows and she is central to policymaking. Of course, CAMP should be one of these vehicles that should inform a lot of what is going on in terms of policymaking in child mental health in general. And so, in line with what Benatka just mentioned, I wanted just to say that if our listeners have done some research, doesn't matter whether it's a positive or a negative finding. That really matters not at all. But if it's something that is likely to change clinical practice or educational policy, they absolutely should consider CAMP. This is the place. This is the place where they should submit stuff, because we want people who read our journals to read an article and say, okay, this is interesting, and I need to consider doing something differently from now on. That's the litmus paper.
And what would you like to try, if in 2 years' time you're looking back, what would you like to say that you've achieved, very particularly from your own experience and your own research interests?
Ideally, what I would like to happen is this. Suppose for a minute that you're a clinician somewhere, and you are faced with a tricky clinical situation, and then you think, I don't know what to do about this particular clinical situation. What I would ideally like to happen is that the first thought that comes to your mind is CAMP. Why don't I open CAMP and see what CAMP has to say about this? And we really want CAMP to have answers not to all possible questions, clinical questions, but to the most interesting, most pressing, most commonly misunderstood. This should be the place where clinicians should look for answers to some of the clinical dilemmas that all of us face every day.
As you should. And Benatka, you mentioned the debate section. This is partly kind of what we're talking about. Sort of, if you have an issue that you don't know the answer to, go to CAMP. This debate section came about, well, could you tell us a bit about sort of the debate, which is on bipolar disorder? Tell us sort of a little bit about it, and also sort of why it's going to be so exciting, so interesting for readers who want to know an answer to bipolar disorder.
Yeah, it's interesting how it came about, because we haven't mentioned that another editor that's recently joined us, Professor Gabrielle Carlson from the United States. And many years ago, I did a small research study with her, and we looked at how clinicians in the United States diagnose bipolar disorder compared to how we do that over here by looking at a series of case vignettes. So what we found, unsurprisingly, was that in the States, clinicians faced at looking exactly the same stories were much more likely to diagnose children and young people with bipolar disorder compared to over here, and I'm always interested in why that was. And somebody called, a researcher called Peter Parry from Australia, was aware that we were both working at this journal, and submitted his own thoughts around this particular subject in relation to a paper that had been published a few years ago by some colleagues in the States. Unsurprisingly, the diagnosed bipolar disorder remains contentious, and Peter Parry has a particular view on it, and our colleagues in the States have different views. And after publishing Peter's article, we received responses from our colleagues in the States who wanted to be able to reply to his thoughts, which we went ahead and published. And then we thought, well, why not let other people wade into this debate? Because it's hugely controversial. It's an international issue. So we invited researchers from all around the world to contribute their thoughts. And hopefully what we've now got is a very interesting series of articles from different researchers from many different countries and get a truly international perspective on this. And we hope it will stimulate and generate thinking amongst our readers as well. For what is a very common problem, if you work, for example, in inpatient services in any parts of the world, this will be the sorts of diagnosis you will be asked about and will be thinking about making. And these series of articles should make you think, am I doing it right? Am I doing it wrong? And what is the right way to go about this?
And particularly in getting different sides of the debate sort of all engaging in the same conversation in the same place in an empirical way just allows you to sort of, if you are approaching it without sort of knowing the answer, then it does allow you to try to find an answer. And this is what you're talking about in terms of going to CAM for the answers to your clinical problems. Is
that's exactly right. So as Bianca rightly said, very often debates could be quite polarizing. That's the nature of debate. If they don't polarize, then there's no point in having a debate. Our view, though, is that we do want to have a robust discussion. However, the point of this discussion is not to necessarily fight different views. The point of the debate is to be educational. The point of the debate is for two people who might have different views on a particular topic to present a coherent set of arguments to support their views, be it on a diagnosis of bipolar disorder or on a number of other issues which we are hoping to address in CAM. Now, the point of the debate is that we don't think that the two senior people, or more senior people who are debating, that they will change their mind. That's not the point. Historically, I don't think anybody has particularly changed their mind as a result of the debate. The point of the debate, however, is to present a set of arguments for the readers to understand two different views and to then make up their own minds. So the debate is not for the benefit of the people who are doing the debate. The debate is for the benefit of the readers, who will be informed about arguments, hopefully will understand more about the evidence base behind these arguments, and then will arrive at a particular conclusion, which again will inform their clinical work and clinical practice. And that's the entire point, for this to be educational, and this for this to be something that is meaningful for the clinician in their everyday life.
In terms of returning to sort of the role of CAM, CAM has the potential to take up, as opposed to other journals, to become a place for this kind of platform, for this kind of discussion. Do you tend to find that anywhere else?
Well, there are other journals that do debates and brief updates. For example, BMJ, which is a well-known journal in the medical world, has similar format in debates. But of course, BMJ or any other journal, general journal will not have, very rarely will have debates on child mental health. And our field is blessed, I'm afraid, with controversies. And there are so many people, you know, in fact, when you think, we were just having a discussion a minute ago about the possible debates for the next Q edition. I think we had no shortage at all of the topics to debate, because unlike many other fields of health, we do have a lot of controversial topics, and also it's not necessarily a bad thing, it's just something that attracts very passionate people who do lots of interesting research and then want to debate their points very strongly. And so it's something that, in that sense, I think is fairly unique, because CAM is not afraid to invite people, it's not afraid of the debate, but also wants it to be very clearly educational focused.
Okay. Before we wrap up, is there anything other that you'd like to say to encourage people to read CAM? Or why you think that it should sort of set the tone for clinical practice in child and adolescent mental health?
I think we'd like to also encourage as many of our international colleagues as possible. At the moment, we've got quite a lot of researchers publishing from the UK, less so from around the world, but we'd really like this to make some international journals possible and understand and learn from clinicians all around the world, from as many countries as possible, from as many disciplines as possible, because it's through working together as multidisciplinary teams that we can achieve the best outcomes for children and young people.
Yeah, I just wanted to echo this and say that every clinician in the world has a paper purely through working with young people. Every clinician within themselves have at least one paper. And some clinicians have significantly more papers. All I wanted to say, we want to see these papers. Don't be afraid of rejection. You know, many of these papers will be rejected, but some will not be rejected. And some will make clinicians think more about their topic and develop their research interests. So I would like to encourage every clinician to look inside themselves and see, is there one paper? Are there two papers? Are there three papers? And submit at least one to CAMP.
Thank you very much, Dennis and Banatka. If you'd like to find out more about ACAM or about CAM, you can find out more on our website, www.acamh.org, or you can follow us on our Twitter handle, @TheCAM.
This podcast was brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short.